that no longer can be expected to infinitely heal itself. Despite all this, the ocean and its nurturing watershed remains our planet's most astonishing catalog of life. If we are to know it, we must preserve it. And to paraphrase what Jacques Cousteau so famously said, if we are to sustain it, we must love it and act to protect it. Yes, let's collect the data, as if that knowledge might be lost to memory. But yes, also, let's join every political and social action locally, nationally, and internationally to restrict and reorder how we engage with the ocean and with that living data that is our inevitable sustenance for the future. Let's collect what we know. Let's put our knowledge to use. Citizens of the ocean, unite. We will discuss these issues and more in future editions of World Ocean Radio.
World Ocean Radio is distributed by the Public Radio Exchange and the Pacifica Network for use by college and community radio stations worldwide. Find us wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts and at worldoceanobservatory.org.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
This program is made possible by KBOO members and support from the League of Women Voters of Portland, providing nonpartisan election information at lwvpdx.org. The League of Women Voters has online voters' guides, videos, and podcasts to help voters understand the state and local candidates and measures that will be on the ballot this November. Nonpartisan voter information is at lwvpdx.org.
Hey, Michael here. I'm with the Tin Can Phone Podcast, a radio show where you can hear about the influence incarceration has straight from the source. We tell you the story from the inside out. So make sure to check us out on KBOO Community Radio every first Tuesday at 10 a.m.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Y'all ready for this?
Ladies and gentlemen.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 0.
Never been done before.
We're talking about a subject.
To bring you to the light.
Farewell to you, people.
Davey D, Hard Knock Radio, hanging out with you this afternoon. Wanted to take a look at what is happening throughout the country on the political landscape. And joining us to help sort some of the things out is political writer for Slate, Alexander Salmon. So I have a lot of questions. And maybe we'll start off with a recent column of yours, because I thought that was pretty insightful. And you talked about the amount of money that is being spent on the Democratic side of things. And the gist of it was that the Democrats have resigned themselves to not spending money on unwinnable races. There are some races that are taking place, at least with regards to the Senate, that I think have captured people's emotions. One in particular is down in Florida against Mark Rubio and Val Demings. A lot of people are hoping that she might be able to pull it out, but they haven't really been putting a lot of money in that, and you spotlighted a few other places where this is happening. Let's start off with that, and then we can maybe drill down into particular races. But I thought that was a pretty interesting thing to note.
Yeah, it's something that, you know, 2 years ago we saw a lot of, where the idea of beating someone like Lindsey Graham in South Carolina was just so enticing, so emotionally sort of like alluring, that Democrats, you know, put a pretty good chunk of change into that race. There was Jamie Harrison was the Democratic candidate, and it was kind of the same story in Iowa. There was a candidate there named Teresa Greenfield, who was a Democrat, and for whatever reason, Democrats really believe that Joni Ernst, who was another, you know, Republican who had helped Brett Kavanaugh get through his nomination process. There were, these really important characters in sort of the political drama of the session prior, and Democrats really wanted to win those. And it ended up being incredibly expensive and ultimately not being fruitful. There are just places where it's very hard to win for Democrats. And if you want to win, you can't win overnight. It's just, you can't just throw money at the problem and fix it. And so this time around, we're actually seeing a much more measured approach. And so the race that you mentioned right in Florida, Marco Rubio, obviously a very prominent Republican, and Democrats have very strong negative feelings about him. And he isn't, that well liked in Florida. He's not, he's not untouchable. But it's a really hard map for Democrats this year. I mean, it's just tough for the president's party in midterms anyways. And they've shied away from throwing huge money at those races that would, feel great. It feels so cathartic to win, but are ultimately much less winnable than other seats elsewhere in the country.
Alexander, let me ask you this. When we talk about money, it's kind of cliched at this point. What does the money go for? Is it TV ads? Is it door knocking? Why would one spend a lot of money in a race?
Yeah, it's mostly advertising. And that's another thing I think is really important to highlight, is that you can only do so much with your ads. You can get on TV, you can get on Facebook, you can get on social media and local news and local papers and everything, but you're not going to really convince a huge percentage of people to vote against someone that they voted for in the past if you don't have an infrastructure in place to do more of that sort of face-to-face contact, that community organizing, the stuff that really builds sort of sustained political victories. And so when you see a party, either one, spending a ton of money, it's usually because A, the candidate, him or herself, is not able to raise the money on their own. And that's where Republicans are having a lot of trouble this year, which is interesting. Their candidates are not able to raise a ton of money independently, so the party's having to spend a bunch to overcome their weakness on that. And then, the other thing is that if you don't have an infrastructure in place where you have unions or community groups or other people who can, sort of make the case for these candidates in a face-to-face manner, you have to spend on ads, and ads cost a lot, especially this time of year. And that's where a lot of the money goes.
So this brings me to another question then. And having, been a part of campaigns where we didn't spend a lot of money and were successful, we come to understand that it's about relationships, and it's about having people who are within your circle who you trust to be able to enlighten you on particular political happenings. So, it might be a local church to say, hey, I don't know about these judges, but somebody in the church can go, this is what we want to do, right? And people go, okay, let's move in that direction. So it's relationship building. And what has often been a complaint about the Democrats is that they take large swaths of their voting population or potential voters for granted. So, for example, you have students. Take a place like Georgia, where it's filled with colleges, or places in Texas. We have tight races filled with colleges. And yet, if you talk to many of the people on those campuses, nobody's really engaged them. They've seen the commercials, but there's not the hands-on relationship building where, money could have been, spent in the local school paper and the subpapers that different ethnic groups and organizations have, highlighting, student leaders, from the Black Union and Latino unions, and really, engaging them. You don't see money spent in those arenas. In other places, I'll point out Florida, for example, you hear the complaint that there's no money being directed towards Black media in those areas, local Black papers. What would be the equivalent to the San Francisco Bayview? What is, I can't remember, in different parts of Florida. So what is it about not really drilling down into particular communities and enhancing, a political presence that, that really focuses on relationship building, establishing trust, and then giving people, you know, at least a suggestion of which direction to take versus, you know, watching an ad, you know, that is, you know, you spent $1 million just to talk to an entire state. And let me just close with this. When we did campaigns in the past, we found that you could just buy ads that only showed up in particular neighborhoods, you know, especially when you're on cable. So if we wanted to talk to Black people in the second ward in Houston, you could actually buy an ad for $25 and talk to Black people in the second ward in Houston versus paying, you know, several thousand dollars to talk to everybody in Houston, which would be a waste of money if you really wanted to drill down to a particular community.
Right, right, absolutely. And I think it's a big problem with the way they do fundraising as well. So if you're a big dollar fundraiser, if you're, you know, a billionaire or someone who's otherwise incredibly wealthy, you want to see your money making an impact, right? And so if you live somewhere, you know, let's say you live in Texas and you gave money to the party and you're seeing an ad on primetime, you know, statewide, you're thinking to yourself, well, that's great, like, look at this impact I'm making. But it's like you said, actually, it's the targeted community stuff that actually can make a much bigger impact. And so, you know, if you go to a big donor and say, hey, we took your money and we parceled it out into 1,000 ad buys and did alt weeklies in this area, and they're going to be like, you know, that's not going to move the needle for them. But if you're like, oh, we're on the Super Bowl or whatever it is, you know, we're on Sunday Night Football, then, you know, then that sort of gets those donors excited. So it actually is core to the whole sort of operation. The way that they raise the money and the way they spend it is right. Sort of, they're both prejudiced towards this kind of flawed method, I think, that doesn't really deliver sustained victories for the party. And
is it really that much of a disconnect, you know, with those donors and the realities that are on the ground? I mean, if I'm a billionaire and I go, Alexander, you know, Salmon, you know, here's some money. The result I want to see is victory, you know, in the ideal thing. And I'm going to trust that you know how to work the levers. But is it really that ego driven? It's like, yo, I gave you $1,000. Where's my ad on the Super Bowl?
I think that that's some of it. I really do. I think that's part of it. I mean, I also think that a lot of people who work campaigns, especially these Senate campaigns, you know, these big statewide races, they're you know, big money, they draw a lot of attention. A lot of these people come out of a certain set of institutions in Washington, D.C., and that it really prejudices them towards a certain way of doing things that I think is often very wrong. And so, you know, there's been a lot of criticism in the past that, you know, at least on the House side for Democrats, the DCCC, which is the big campaigns arm for the House, for House Democrats nationally, you know, that they just didn't have enough staffers who were not white. That just, there's so many consultants and so many fundraisers who come from the same communities. They're white, they have the same class background, and so they all see this stuff the same way, and they don't have access or even think to reach out to people in some of the ways that you're suggesting. And yeah, I think that is, you know, obviously there are different levels of this, but I think that's a big part of it as well.
So the consultant class is something that has to be factored into a lot of elections. So yeah. With that being said, from your experience as a political reporter, compare the consultant class to the Democrats versus the consultant class on the Republican side or the right side of things. How do they kind of roll, and does one have a more intuitive and better handle on how to really, you know, massage the machine and get people's hearts and minds than the other?
Yeah, I guess I would have two separate stories to tell about this. One of them is that Republicans are much better at ads. You know, the sort of, like, you know, the propaganda side of things, you know, the red meat ads, and I don't know if you've been watching baseball lately, you know, you see these ads about these illegal immigrants who came to this United States, these horribly racist, you know, just, you know, almost uncomfortable ads, but they're better at that. And so when they get money to do that, I think that they have historically been more effective at converting those sorts of things into votes. And so, you know, that's an advantage for them. And Democrats have not been as good at that. Democrats have been really good at raising money lately, but I think they're less good at sort of getting on the airwaves and turning that into votes. And And I think that the interesting thing is that now that there's so much money actually on both sides, that you're seeing both groups dabble in the things that, that the other group does well. And so something that I was reporting on earlier this year was Republican groups at the national level, the RNC put a bunch of money towards community centers, especially in non-white neighborhoods. And so there are something like 30, at least 30 of these centers in places that are majority minority throughout the country. And they're sponsored by the Republican Party, and they have pizza night and movie night, and they have English classes and voter registration. And you know, they really are trying to meet the social and economic needs of communities where they're, you know, where they don't have those things. And,
right, and the Democrats, you know, the Democrats have pulled back on that sort of thing.
Exactly.
Which is ironic. You know, as you was talking, you know, one of the things that seems to be a often debated lever is the role of culture, right? So I'm looking at, you know, Candace Owens has a documentary out around George Floyd, and you know, where she's saying that, you know, all this propaganda around it, and the distraction is George Floyd, but the real propaganda is that it feeds into red meat and, you know, and crime being the real problem and yada yada yada. So it's going to be something that really gets a particular base riled up and ready to go. And you ask yourself the question, well, what's the equivalent to that? You know, what's on the other side of the track, you know, culturally speaking, to get people motivated? And you're looking and you're looking and you're looking and you're, and you know, I think you alluded to, I might see, you know, a Trevor Noah on, you know, on his show. But, you know, the average person that you really need to get to go to the polls ain't watching Trevor Noah like that. And even if you are, you know, what's the investment online? Because people like to listen and watch things on demand. So, you know, I play Madden, you know, online, you know, so that's my thing. And NPK, I don't see any ads for any of these candidates in those spaces. You know, right. Call of Duty's coming out with the new game. You know, there's no ads on that. You can buy ads on those things, but it's like, how do you miss these things? You know, you go to went to the Warrior game the other night. There was no candidates out there, you know what I'm saying? To tell you to vote. You just didn't see the engagement. And it's like, how do you miss things that are so obvious when it's like a major thing? You know, football games have started, and you can ask, you know, were they engaging those 60, 70,000 people that went to these games, whether it's in Florida or North Carolina or any of these places?
Right, right. Yeah, absolutely.
So your standpoint is, so they missed the big misses on that? No money invested in those arenas?
Yeah, well, it's interesting because it's almost, the amount of money that's being spent is so huge that I think that probably, you know, there you could probably find some of this stuff in a lot of places, but I think it really, you're right that, like, and especially, you know, youth outreach is a huge issue, and you know, I think you're really wise to bring up gaming as a possible forum to sort of meet younger people where they are, and that sort of stuff is, you know, again, that's going to decide whether Democrats win or lose in the fall is if young people show up or not. And I don't think they really know how to contact them. I mean, when you're spending all this money on TV ads, like, if you're under 35, how much cable TV do you watch? Probably not very much. I mean, it just, you know, it just, and I don't think they have a really sort of cutting edge.
You're streaming right. Most of the time. And right. When you say young people, I think maybe we need to find a new word for it, because I think in the minds there's a disconnect. You say young people, you're thinking, oh, the cute little teenagers. And I'm talking like, no, your 40-year-old is playing N2K on the weekends, man. Your 35-year-old went to the basketball game. You know, it wasn't young kids like you're thinking. These are, you know, significant 20 plus, you know, 20 to 30, 40-year-olds that you're talking about.
Right, right. Yeah, millennials now, right, of course.
Yeah, they're millennials now, yeah.
Right, up into that range. So, yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And right, the change in media consumption, I think, is really important. Obviously, paradigm shift. And yeah, you have to be reactive to that. And you know, I'm hard-pressed to believe that they're really on the cutting edge of doing that at this moment.
As a reporter, do you get into conversations with any of these folks when you're, you know, when you're on the scene, and, you know, do they tell you things? Do you share some of your insight, you know, you being young yourself, to say, hey, man, you know? you're missing where I'm at.
Yeah. No, I think, I mean, the interesting thing is that I will say the people that I've talked to in the past are actually a little more optimistic this time. You know, for all the failures, I think, of the outreach apparatus on the Democratic side, at least there's a sense that at least this time that the party is more willing to fight, you know, fight it out and get their knuckles a little bloody in some of these races. And even that's not something we used to see very much. I mean,
right.
If you even think back to 2010, it was like the actual strategy was Obamacare will speak for itself. We just signed this law. Like, we don't need to talk about it. You know, like, we don't need to bring anything up. And obviously that was a catastrophe. And this time I think that there's a sense that, like, you know, you really got to insult Dr. Oz. Like, you got to make it very clear, like, you know, this guy, who he is and where the difference is, where the difference lies. And I think that, you know, I think that obviously appeals to, you know, especially if you're, you know, a younger Democratic voter, you're probably far to the left of where the party is, generally speaking. And, right. You know, you don't want to hear about how they're working together with Republicans. Like, you don't want to hear about how they're doing these bipartisan half measures. Like, you want to hear that they're going to stick it to Republicans who are trying to take away your rights. Like, that's
right.
You know, a different message. And they're doing a little more of that. The question is it enough? Is it going to the right places?
Right. We're talking with Alexander Salmon, if you're just tuning in, political writer, getting a look at what's happening nationally. And we started off our conversation building off of a column where he talked about how money's being spent. So I had to pick your brain on that. But let's look at some of the races. You talked about Dr. Oz and the Fetterman race. John Fetterman, is, I believe, is his name in Pennsylvania.
Okay. Yeah.
And so that's been a whirlwind of a race. You know, maybe you could fill us in. I mean, at one point Fetterman was like had a stroke or a heart attack and we thought he was gone and out, and then he's back. And then Oz was making some really big, you know, goofs and mistakes and seemed like, okay, he's not going to win. And now it's a neck and neck race. So what's the deal with that race in Pennsylvania?
Yeah. It's a really interesting race because I think it was the one that Democrats felt most comfortable about up until, you know, just a couple of days ago. I think, you know, if you would have asked me even last week, I would have said, yeah, Democrats aren't sweating that race. Now they're sweating it. But Fetterman is, you know, Fetterman's Democrat. He's a lieutenant governor of the state of Pennsylvania. So he's won statewide. He has a reputation for being, you know, an effective local politician. He's been in office for a while. And he has a lot of purchase with, you know, working class voters that, you know, Democrats have really struggled to court. So in a lot of ways, you would say this is a really strong candidate for Democrats. Biden won Pennsylvania. It's a good pickup opportunity. And on the other side, you have Dr. Oz, who, you know, won his primary by just a couple thousand votes. I mean, really squeaked through
People don't know, Dr. Oz is the actual TV personality that we see on TV. So, yeah,
right.
trying to follow the footsteps of Ronald Reagan and, you know, and Jesse Ventura and a few other people, you know,
yeah,
Sonny exactly. Bono, you know, folks who've been on TV and said, let me, you know, and even Trump.
Right. Exactly. Yeah, it's exactly the trajectory there. And right. You know, someone who's like a made for TV doctor who like made a bunch of money selling sugar pills, claiming that they were going to help you lose weight, and you know, exceptionally well, made a ton of money off of that, and doesn't really live in Pennsylvania. He lives in New Jersey. He hasn't, you know, held office. He's, you know, the whole thing is just this perfect. He's an exceptionally weak candidate. Is you know, the long and the short of it. And so, a lot of vulnerabilities, and you would think that it couldn't be more different. You know, you have this like super rich, out of town, Johnny come lately sort of politician who is totally new to Republican politics and is, you know, is Trump backed but you know, really doesn't have any constituency beyond that. And then you have this guy in Fetterman who, you know, has really been a politician in Pennsylvania, has a reputation, and then Fetterman had a stroke, which I think, you know, in an unfortunate way really served as a reset for the race. And so he was off the campaign trail for a while, and in the meantime, Republicans have sent a ton of money to Dr. Oz. So they've been able to close the gap a little bit with that. And I think that Democrats are now starting to spend on behalf of Fetterman. For a while, they didn't even think that Fetterman needed help. I mean, they were happy to let him run that race and win it without assistance. But now you know, there's money coming in on both sides, and the amount of Republican spending on that race is just gigantic.
So let me ask you, where did they gain ground? If the Lieutenant Governor Fetterman appeals to the working class, if we're talking about Pennsylvania, we're talking about, you know, the T-shape, right? Philly and Pennsylvania are on the east and west sides, and then in the middle where you have Scranton and all that other stuff, right, is the quote-unquote working class. You know, that's Joe Biden was supposed to be able to make way through that. Bill Clinton was supposed to be able to appeal to that, I guess, ideal, you know, soccer mom, working class, you know, hard hat guy. So Fetterman, that should be his wheelhouse in theory. What's happened? Did he lose ground in that place? Or where is Dr. Oz, who for the most part, because of his profession and what he does, would seem to be more elitist than Fetterman? Where was the game?
Right, absolutely. Yeah, and you know, I, to be perfectly honest, I'm surprised by how much ground he's made, just based on what we're seeing in polling. And the polling is tough to make, you know, it's tough to know one way or the other. But I think that what we've seen so far in the sort of prevailing story on this is that there have been ads attacking Fetterman on crime. That's really the big thing. Uh-huh. Republicans have really sort of like made their hay is just hammering on crime, right? There's this crime scare, and you know, it's one of these things that's really not in evidence. You know, if we look at crime rates now versus where they were 10 years ago or anywhere else, there's no crime wave. No substantial, you know, increase in crime over a long period of time here. But I think there has been a local sort of uptick in crime in the last year or so. And Republicans right. do very well with that. They know exactly how to make that work for them. And so they've been, you know, I think Fetterman at some point in his career was involved with getting people paroled, getting them out of prison, especially for minor offenses, that sort of stuff. You know, common sense criminal justice reform stuff that, you know, even Republicans claimed to support not that long ago, but now it's all crime wave, total.
So let me ask you this then. Crime, or the perception of it, would be in places like Philly and Pennsylvania, I mean, not Philly and Pennsylvania, Philly and Pittsburgh, right? The big cities. But the votes that Fetterman really could and should be able to appeal to are away from the cities. They're in the rural parts. So how does this crime wave, which in theory has been, the narrative has been, look what's going on in Philly. Why does somebody in Scranton care about what's going on in Philly 2.5 hours away? You know, how and does that translate to other places where you have these Senate races where if the Republicans are trying to get those rural votes, right, they're not really going to be able to make it out the city. These people that live in these rural places, they don't live and they, I don't think they even go to these places with the frequency that you would think. In other words, are they affected by crime or are they affected by the perception?
Yeah, right. It's all about the perception, of course. And right, that's what's so amazing about it is, you know, in these places where the crime is actually occurring, you have a person like Larry Krasner, who's the district attorney of Philadelphia, you know, who's been, you know, at the forefront of doing criminal justice reform, getting people out of prison. He was reelected recently in Philadelphia, right?
He kicked ass in his race.
Right, and so, you know, it's people in Philadelphia aren't concerned about this, but right, it's exactly the sort of thing. It's like, if you can get people who don't, you know, it isn't affecting them because they aren't even there, but you get them all worked up, and it's the same thing with, you know, it's like the way the Republicans use border security in places that are thousands of miles from the border. It's, you know, in Montana, they're running ads, you know, about how there's this surge of illegal immigration at the southern border. And it's like, that couldn't be farther away from, you know, the voters there. But that's actually why it has some, you know, some salience, is because they can't look out their window and see that it's not true. And that's exactly the sort of formula they're using in this race.
So the Democrats ran on, you know, thought that they had a gift when the Supreme Court overturned Roe versus Wade, and they put all their chips in that. They was like, we're going to run on that. There was that electoral victory in Kansas where they was like, see, we can roll. So they rolled the dice even as recently as, you know, Biden speaking the other day and saying, hey, the first thing I'm going to do if we get more senators is codify Roe v. Wade. But then you start to see these reports and they're saying that women, in particular those suburban women, translate white women, are like, yeah, but the economy is more important. So what's happening with that? Is there any ground to gain on the abortion thing, the abortion ruling, or does the economy really trump things, no pun intended, along with this crime wave that haven't even directly impacted these folks?
Yeah, I think, I really do think it does have an impact. I think that the abortion stuff is going to play. I think it's going to be important for Democrats. I think at the very least, you know, we could be talking about a massive red wave right now, you know, and just given the nature, you know, of how these elections go out, you know, for the president's party after 2 years, and the gerrymandering, everything else, like we could be talking about Republicans winning a ton of seats, and we're not. We're talking about them, you know, maybe taking the House back, but not by a bunch. And so I think that's, you know, that the abortion factor has played a big role in sort of like in making, you know, a narrower outcome look more likely. And I think it will continue to play a role. I think it's really hard. Honestly, I think it's really hard to pull this stuff right now. I mean, it seems like every election cycle we're like, oh my God, these polls missed by so much. And just based on the voter registration data that we're seeing, new voters registering, especially women, especially younger voters, it's really hard to know who's going to turn out exactly in November. And it may be that that really does make a difference. But on the flip side, there's a school of thought that says that gas prices are maybe the most important thing for the electoral fate of a party in any election. And gas prices are up. And the thing is that Democrats have really courted suburban voters. And as you point out, you know, a lot of like white suburban women have been courted by the party as part of this winning coalition they think they put together. And, you know, when gas prices are through the roof, those are the people that are paying for, you know, so right. Those people that are paying to fill up their SUV and drive it, you know, all over the place. And, you know, so those are the people that might be a little fickle when the gas prices go up. And that's the risk of having built that coalition, is that, you know, those are the things that might alienate those people. And I think there's probably good reason to be a little bit worried about their
fitness. Do they blame Biden for this?
I think that there's a lot of, yes, definitely. I think there's a lot of frustration towards Biden for the, you know, for gas prices, for inflation generally. And, you know, in the absence of a narrative to explain why prices are up and what's going on, it makes sense. I think Democrats have a really good story to tell about why actually inflation is not their fault, but, you know, is corporate profit taking. And, you know, I think there's a really good story to tell there, but I don't know how much that story is being told.
So who are the key players to go out and be almost ambassadors to kind of, you know, paint this narrative, you know, to say, you know, hey, gas is high, but, you know, as a woman, you know, I'm thinking like what celebrity big name people that would connect with that suburban housewife that is, you know, at least they're saying is moving away because of gas prices to counter. Who do they have on call? Who's the superstar? It used to be Michelle Obama. I think she's kind of tired of that. But you know, but who's the equivalent? Who's her match?
Yeah, I haven't seen exactly anyone that I would think that would fill that role. I mean, I know that they've sent Barack Obama back out on the trail a little bit, so he's back out there doing it again. They've dispatched Bernie Sanders to a handful of places, especially states where he's popular. And places where Biden's unpopular, they've kept Biden at home. Right. So, you know, they sent Biden to California and places where, you know, he polls pretty favorably, but they're not letting him go anywhere near, you know, Arizona or places where he's really underwater. So, you know, it's an interesting problem, right? It's, you know, it is kind of the same old crew there, and they don't have a lot of, you know, sort of new young ambassadors to relay the message. And yeah, that's, you know, one of many challenges for driving that home.
So Alexander Shemin, let's look at some of these Senate races. We talked about Florida. We talked a little bit about Pennsylvania. Wisconsin seems to be a place that is kind of bubbling. And of course, everybody, all eyes on Georgia, Herschel Walker and Warnock. Maybe we start there. How does Warnock allow himself to be in a tight race with Herschel Walker? I mean, you pastor the Church of Dr. King. You're in the center of the civil rights, a bastion of the civil rights struggle, you know, this should be a home run. And yet, you know, somebody was remarking the other day, man, you see that debate and it's like, he's putting you to sleep. There's no dynamism. It's like, you're a preacher. You should be able just on that alone. So what is happening? Is he playing it too cautious, or is he just a bad candidate, or is Herschel Walker doing something to capture, you know, some people's imagination?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think that the best way I can explain the Herschel Walker phenomenon is that he just has so much money that the party, the Republican Party, has already invested in him so much that they basically are like, we're all in. We're just going to keep putting money on the table, and like, we can't turn back now. So
even with his contradictions, right?
Yeah, right.
Even
right.
when it found out that, you know, this far right, you know, pro-life guy paid for a couple of abortions. They're like, I think somebody said, what is it? I don't care if he paid to abort a chicken, you know, as long as we take over the Senate.
Right, right, exactly. And so I think that they know he's a bad candidate, but they're like, look, we already put, you know, $100 million into this. We're not turning back now. So he has a, you know, he has the money on his side, and also the, you know, the sort of the nature of these, you know, the challenge for the president's party in a midterm election. Those things are working on his behalf. I think that Warnock is a very good politician. I think that you know, I think if he wins this race, it's not crazy to talk about him as a presidential candidate at some point.
Really?
And the question is, can he survive? And I think that you're right to point out that he has been a little timid when it comes to criticizing Herschel Walker on some of this stuff, and the appeal that he's been making on the campaign trail has been, you know, I've worked with Republicans, I've reached across the aisle, I've done this bipartisan stuff, you know.
Who's telling him to do that?
Right, right.
That's the question. Nobody wants to hear that. You right. know, if I came and kicked your family member in the teeth and you know, and talk bad about them in the process, the last thing you want to hear is like, hey man, we're gonna maybe work with Dave's family and across the aisle. It's like, really? No.
Right, right, exactly. And right, it's tough to reconcile like this messaging. It's like, you know, if Republicans win, they're going to end elections as we know them and threat to democracy. But also, we've been working with them to pass a bunch of stuff that we both like. Like, it doesn't, you can't really say both things. It doesn't really work. So it is a challenge. I am curious to see how it'll work out. I would have thought that this race was over a million times by now, but it's not over. It's very tight. And you know, I think that you know, if it does turn out that Warnock loses, I think that's the question we'll have to be asking: is why was he so cautious about hitting Warnock on all of his foibles and his horrible track record?
You mean Walker?
Sorry, why was he so right? Exactly. Why was he so cautious on hitting Herschel Walker on his track record, and you know, why play up the bipartisanship? And yeah, I you know, I don't know, but I do think that. I will say Warnock has been a good senator in his time in D.C. He's done a good job, and I think he's a talented speaker. And I think that if he makes it through this, we're probably talking about him as one of the futures of the party. But he also might not make it through. It's very possible.
You know, there's been a conversation. We'll probably be digging into this in the upcoming weeks to try and separate black men from women in this race. You know, in some very insidious ways, you know, the whole Kanye thing is one way, you know, to try and appeal. There seems to be this, you know, brothers ain't getting any sort of play, but we got to contextualize that black men are still going to vote 90%, you know, as usual. But it seems like the expectation is that black men have got to vote in the high 90s while everybody else gets to be 60, 40, 70, 30, you know, all the other different ethnic groups. So the question is, one, does Warnock feel that he needs to make a special appeal to black men if it's going to be a close race and you don't want to have a few, you know, peeled off and going over to Walker for whatever reason? And two, has there been an investment in other constituencies that have that 60-40, 70-30 split, maybe get them to, you know, to move the dial a little?
Right, right. Yeah, that's, I mean, the incredible thing is that the margins are so slim here, you know, like the amount of votes that are going to decide this is it's almost unbelievable how what it'll come down to. And so you know, Republicans, right, they've been trying to court black men more and more, and they've made an effort. They have these community centers I was referencing earlier. They've got two of them in Georgia, and
oh wow.
So and in places like College Park's not going to be a Republican, you know, district. It's, but if you get a couple percent here and there, you know, that's really all it takes. And then I think there's a really big question as well for, you know, the Latino population in Georgia and the Asian population in Georgia. I mean, it's a very diverse state, and those are both racial groups that Republicans have really pushed to.
But those are the groups where you have those 60-40, 70-30 right. splits. So right. have the Democrats tried to, you know, ramp that up a little, go on to Latino voters, for example, where you're having these insidious ads about quote unquote illegal immigration and demonizing them and try to you flip that to the advantage? And have they been able to make an appeal, which I thought was key to Warnock's success, you know, in the Asian community, which is bustling in places like Georgia?
Right, absolutely. Yeah, you know, I've heard anecdotally from people who I know who work on campaigns on the Senate side that they're doing more of this, that there has been an attempt to, you know, to like, you know, hire more Latino consultants and staffers and you know, get in that community and make a more authentic appeal to them, which I think is heartening. I think also you've seen some of the polling, you know, I'm sure you've seen a ton of it rolling through that, you know, it says that, you know, one day it'll say that the Democrats are doing no worse with Latinos than they were doing before. And the next day it'll be like, but they did so badly last, you know, in 2020. So I think it's really hard to know. I think that there's an awareness on both sides of how important these groups are. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it's going to catch anyone by surprise, which is nice. I think that they've been caught by surprise in the past. But I also think that, you know, that Republicans are really making a push there, and it's going to be, you know, it's going to be difficult. You have to give voters a really strong reason to vote for you. And I think that when Warnock ran last time, he had a really strong economic populist message. It was, you know, it was the stimulus checks that they were running on, and then anti-corruption. I mean, you both those Republican Senate candidates in Georgia had been popped for insider right. trading. And, you know, those two things I think are really, really winning messages. And I don't know that I have a sense that they have the exact same sort of power or potency this time around in their messaging. But, I think that they have to know that that's what worked last time. Right. So,
does the January 6th hearing play any role in this, in deciding any of these races, any of these Senate races?
I think, you know, it's really hard for me to know. I just based on the groups they need to turn out, like, you know, as we were talking about younger voters, like, I don't think younger voters were watching CNN at like 1 p.m. when the last, you know,
right.
Hearing came on. I do think it's been useful in some sense, because I think it has sort of given some meat to the argument that this is a very urgent situation. I think that probably if it happened in concert with some actual prosecutions and arrests, you know, some actual accountability, that might be more meaningful. But, you know, I certainly don't think it hurt. And obviously, at some point, Democrats were happy to let this just, you know, go quietly into the night. So I think it was better that they did something. But I don't know. Yeah, I'm not sure exactly.
Well, those hearings are going to stop if they're the switchover. I think right. they're trying to wrap this up now.
Right.
Because if they lose come January, they'd be like, right. yeah, let's disband that and keep it moving.
Right, right. And everyone's pardoned and the whole thing is over. Yeah, no, I agree with you. And I think, yeah, I think a lot of Democrats, a lot of people who voted Democrat really wanted to see some accountability for people that
right.
were obviously breaking the law. I mean, that's just a, you know, and that's, again, that's a way to sort of recast the crime argument, is to say, look, there are people acting with impunity here. They're the super rich and the elites in this country they break the law all the time, and including an attempt to overthrow the government. I mean, what could be more ridiculous than that?
Yeah, I thought that was a missed opportunity. When people talk to me about crime, I go, you're right. They haven't been prosecuting these criminals, and I point to January 6th. Right. And we keep, you know, let's get this going. I want to see these people go to jail, you know. Want to see criminals go to jail, and you include right. them in that statistic. But, you know, I'm not running these campaigns, so I'm just watching them, you know, use words that don't connect the dots, you know.
Right.
If little Johnny can steal a catalytic converter and not go to jail, well, of course, because, you know, Mr. Smith, you know, stole stuff off Nancy Pelosi's desk and maybe even got a couple of police officers killed and right. didn't go to jail.
Right.
Even Stephen, I guess. Absolutely. But, you know, as we close out, I wanted to ask about the other races. I think I mentioned Wisconsin. How's that shaping up, and any other things that you would alert our listeners to maybe pay close attention to?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I think Wisconsin will be an interesting one. Wisconsin, obviously, the state that Biden won, but won very narrowly. Mandela Barnes, also a lieutenant governor of the state, so someone who's won statewide. So you'd think would be in a position to make a pretty good go of it. There doesn't seem to be a ton of confidence about his candidacy right now. He's up against Ron Johnson, who is far to the right, even for in the Republican caucus, very extreme. Opposed to, he said he would vote against the gay marriage codification if it came to the Senate. You'd think this is a pretty vulnerable candidate, but there's not a lot of confidence being projected about this race. And I think that part of it is that Mandela Barnes actually, as lieutenant governor, was very progressive and has run this kind of weird campaign where he's disavowed a bunch of the progressive stuff and has been like, I'm actually a moderate. And it just doesn't scan very well,
The consultant class told him to get rid of a bunch of things.
Totally.
And so now he's not himself. Now he seems phony baloney.
Exactly. So I think that's kind of the challenge on that race. The other race two more races probably worth flagging. One is North Carolina, which Democrats have wanted to win for so long and have just been unable to do it. They haven't won statewide there since 2000 for 14 years. 2008 was the last time.
Wow.
And so they always think it's about to happen, and it never is. But this is a race too, where it's a very weak Republican candidate and Ted Budd, who, is a co-sponsor of the national abortion bill. He's been in the pocket of big bank mergers and a bunch of stuff that obviously does not look very compelling for the average American voter. And Sherry Beasley the Democrat has won statewide, but it was for the state Supreme Court. So it's not really the same sort of thing, but Democrats are allowing themselves to believe they could win there. The polling there has been really tight even until very recently. That could be one place where they surprise. And then the last place is in Ohio. And Ohio is obviously, not a place where Democrats have done very well recently, but they have one Democratic senator in Sherrod Brown. The Republican candidate J.D. Vance is very weak as well, and the Democrat Tim Ryan is running a pretty good campaign. So that's one of those ones where.
So Ohio's interesting because we have good folks that were there, that ran those campaigns under Obama, and they were successful. And they did all that investment. They went to the black bike clubs like the Rough Riders, and they did all these different things. They went to all the nooks and crannies and touched people. And then under Hillary, she pulled back and said, let me go after, what's his name, Kasich, the former governor, the Republican governor, said, we're going to try for him. And I remember the sister that ran those campaigns came on our show and said, they're going to lose by 200,000 votes. She called this like about 2 weeks out of time. And it's like, really? And said, sure enough. And, the rest is history. 2016, they lost by 200,000, which was crazy. And they haven't been on track since. And so I would have thought that they would have went back to what was the winning formula under Obama and touched those folks. But I guess they haven't. They're still trying to court the moderate Republicans. And is that ever going to work? Has that worked anywhere?
Right. It's a great question. And right. So far the answer seems to be no. And I, I think you're absolutely right. Right. There was a way to win there not that long ago. And, I don't know why, but we keep trying the same things over and over again. It seems like, I think that's a really, really great point that there was a winning coalition there for Obama and they knew where to find it. And since then the Democrats have been a really,
they divested from it.
Exactly.
And went elsewhere. Alexander Salmon, we appreciate you coming on. Let people know how we can keep in touch and read your articles and, follow you. And also, as you close out, maybe you can give us your prediction if you have one.
Oh, boy. I'm writing at Slate. So you can catch all my stuff pretty much at Slate. And I'm on Twitter. My handle is Alex_Salmon. Last name is Sammon. My prediction, oh man, being in the prediction business is so rough because I feel like no matter whatever I say, it's going to come back to bite me. I think that I feel a little more, you know, right now Democrats are freaking out about basically every race. I think Fetterman will win in Pennsylvania. I think Warnock will hold on in Georgia. I think that probably it ends up, I think that Barnes loses, Beasley loses, Tim Ryan loses in Ohio. Democrats maybe go 51-49 in the Senate. I think they'd be pretty happy with that. But I could be wrong, and probably for saying it, just by saying it out loud, probably ensures that that won't happen. So,
well, we shall see. It's going to be close, and we appreciate you coming on and sharing with us, you know, some of these insights, and hopefully people that hear us in either some of the states that we're on will act accordingly, and folks who have relatives in some of those places will, you know, have those conversations. I think it's going to be, at the end of the day, voter turnout. Whoever can get their people to the polls is going to carry the day, and not in the traditional sense, but it's really about, I have a strong base that's committed, and they're riding, you know, no matter what, you know, like literally, you know, some of their candidates could shoot somebody in the street, and they're right. Like, we're going to have to roll with them so we can keep the Senate. And if that passion can be matched, then you're going to have, you know, maybe a victory. But if people, it's kind of like, well, like you said, I'm trying to dance with people on the other side of the aisle. That's not a very appealing, you know, argument, but yeah, who am absolutely. I to say? Alexander, thank you so much. We're going to take a break on Hard Knock Radio. We'll be right back.
Hard Knock, turn the speakers in your car up. Quality program, turn in for the real talk. Don't stop. EMN at it again. Sandman, Adamant, Chris Juwan, Cam. Yeah. Innovation, stimulating ill conversation. Anything else, just imitation. Simulation, step into the zone. The Bay Area zone. Hard Knock Radio, let's go. Big shout out to Nita and Davey D. Yeah, right, feel me. Yeah. Honing down at Hard Knock Radio.
Hard Knock Radio.
Kind of crazy, though.
Yeah.
Oakland, stand up.
Yeah. Stand up.
Ensemble, Big Night Wolves.
Yeah. Kansas City.
Yeah. Yeah.
Bellevue. Yeah. Come on. Check out.
Why every novice think they hard knock when they ain't going all in and ain't paid the cost of the fee? Hating that they made they beats, trying to eat till they made it from the steel crate. Beats, say please. Maybe they'll save you a seat at the table with a great bread making a speech. Say some peace to the lovers I neighbor to please. Hey, there's some shade on your name in the street. Let's go.
Real Talk Radio.
You are now rocking with the best in the West.
Yes, Coast. Monday through Friday.
Sing it, Chris.
Let's go.
The death of the death penalty. In a stunning surprise, the jury, hearing sentencing arguments in the case of Nicholas Cruz, at the Stoneman Douglas School, Parkland, Florida, for the killing of 17 people, recommended that Cruz be sentenced to life in prison instead of the death penalty. 17 others were wounded in this mass shooting. Few people, especially the surviving families of the victims, expected Cruz could escape a death sentence. For the state labored long and hard to prove that Cruz committed aggravated offenses in the shootings, and the jurors agreed with him that he qualified for such a sentence. His defense lawyers, however, produced a fetal alcohol syndrome defense, arguing that his mother used drugs and alcohol during her pregnancy. This behavior, they argued, resulted in brain damage to Cruz. The state produced a psychologist who threw cold water on this theory, but the jury didn't buy it, or they didn't want to buy it. One might ask, if the death penalty doesn't apply here, where 34 people were shot and 17 killed. When does it apply? And that, of course, is the question. We may be looking at the beginning of the end for the death penalty. With love, not fear, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
All's my life I has to fight. All's my life I hard times like yeah, bad trips like yeah. Nazareth, I'm f***ed up, homie, you f***ed up. But if God got us, then we gon' be alright. And when I wake up, I recognize you looking at me for the pay cut. Bahamas, I be looking at you from the face down. One Mac 11, even boom with the bass down. Skimming, and let me tell you about my life. Painkillers only put me in the twilight. We're pretty Benjamin is the highlight. And I tell my mama I love her, but this what I like. Lord knows, 20 of them in my Chevy. Tell them all to come and get me, reaping everything I sow. So my karma come in heaven, no preliminary hearings on my record. I'm a f***ing gangsta in silence for the record. Tell the world I know it's too late. Boys and girls, I think I've gone crazy. Trying to side my face this all day. Won't you please believe when I say, when you know we've been hurt, been down before. When our pride was low, looking at the world like, where do we go? And we hate po-po, wanna kill us dead in the street for sure. I'm at the preacher's door, my knees getting weak and my gun might blow, but we gon' be alright.
Hi, this is Pat Metheny. You're listening to Radio KBOO here in Portland.
Welcome to World Ocean Radio. I'm Peter Neal, director of the World Ocean Observatory. If climate change solutions have been hampered by structure and performance that have not resulted in return on massive funding commitments to climate change and ocean protection, what can we do to change the strategy, to eliminate the middlemen, and to put the available funds into the hands not of bureaucrats and planners, but of those who will succeed by doing? My email box is inundated with reports and studies, and I follow the NGOs and environmental organizations with avid interest, hoping I will find another way, an organization or model that will allow for funds to bypass the interval between lofty discussion and practical matters. I think I may have found it. In 2014, an organization was founded in San Francisco by Daniela Fernandez, the Sustainable Ocean Alliance, or SOA, with the mission, quote, to activate young people, develop and implement innovative solutions, and mobilize an ocean workforce to restore the health of the ocean in our lifetime, unquote. Let me emphasize four parts of that equation: young people, innovative solutions, workforce, and in our lifetime. To meet those criteria was, from the start, a provocative goal. The ocean constituency is, for the most part, older, professional, and committed to established ways. Innovation, by definition, was an attack on convention, and solutions set a more defined level of expectations for outcome. Workforce meant people on the ground, on the water, where the hard, dirty work of conservation has to be practiced in real time, real cause, real effect, real risk, real solution. And finally, in our lifetime, demands that work can no longer be measured by any other standard than the palpable urgency of real time, now. This month, SOA announced results, providing facts and figures about 222 solutions to heal, restore, and sustain our ocean. The range of accomplishment defines the breadth of the problem. Here are their categories and statistics. Ocean Solution Accelerator, providing funding, mentorship to scale ocean ventures and amplify their impact. 45 ocean companies in 29 countries. $950,000 invested to leverage $228 million in new projects within the blue economy. Ocean Leadership Program, to support 6,000 participants with resources and networks needed to build ocean healing solutions and leadership potential. 177 microgrant projects, $416,000 to support 600 jobs created. Blue carbon, CO2 reduced, avoided, or sequestered, 15 solutions with 15,540 metric tons extracted. Pollution reduction and the circular economy, 62 solutions with 1,775 metric tons of solid waste removed, upcycled, or avoided. Ecosystem preservation and restoration, 34 solutions, 89,128 square meters of blue carbon ecosystems protected and restored. Ocean data literacy and research, 81 solutions that have monitored 150,000 kilometers of coastline for climate change adaptation, saved 67,000 whales from marine collision, produced 150 ocean literacy reports, 260 events with 30,000 youth participants. Blue foods, 30 solutions aligned to sustainable proteins, fisheries, and agriculture. I urge you to visit the Sustainable Ocean Alliance at soalliance.org to read the full report in complete detail to join and support the effort. The areas of engagement have been long identified and are embedded in the UN Sustainable Development Goals and other high-level plans and recommendations, and good work is being done in these areas by others. But what is key here is the scale and connection that have been established as new criteria for investment and commitment. Some of these first outcomes may seem small, but the system is now in place, valued, and ready to scale to even greater numbers and as even greater solutions in all ocean places around the world. Every young person involved, every mentor, every fisher or coastal inhabitant, every innovator, every citizen of the ocean with a determined commitment can now see results of individual and collective labor, of bright ideas or opportunities to follow, of success that can be realized. What will it take? Just this: imagination, commitment, personal engagement, hard work, measurable results, social benefit, communal spirit. Thank you, Daniela Fernandez, your colleagues, and all those you have enabled to join, solve, heal, restore, and sustain the global ocean. Don't stop now. This is where real hope lies. We will discuss these